This episode of New Politics was released on the 18th of June, 2022, and produced on the land of the Wangal and Whadjuk people.
Welcome to New Politics. In this episode, the price of electricity has become the new focus of attention in politics, Labor still being blamed for all the problems caused by the coalition, and what are the key factors behind the election loss for Scott Morrison? I'm Eddie Djokovic, editor of New Politics.
I'm David Lewis. I was born to dance.
And a big thank you to our new Patreon subscribers. Thanks for signing up. And if you'd like to support New Politics, you can support us through a Patreon subscription. It's just $5 per month for the Ruby Standard supporter level or $10 per month for the Gold Standard supporter level. But whether it's a subscription or if you just want to listen in, read our material online or buy a t-shirt or buy a book, it's all available at newpolitics.com.au. And all of this is a good way to support independent journalism. Everyone now seems to be talking about energy. The media is taking a strong interest in it now after seemingly not having that much interest in it over the past 9 years. But a change of government does seem to sharpen the mind on certain issues. The opposition under Peter Dutton is offering suggestions about what the government needs to do on energy policy, talking up the need for nuclear power as part of the mix, even though every report that has been commissioned over the past 60 years has shown that nuclear power in Australia is not a viable energy source. And this includes a report commissioned by the previous Liberal National Government as recently as 2019. We haven't heard yet from the Labor Government about how it intends to resolve these energy resource issues. In the past, they have mentioned that renewables and green energy should be part of the mix going into the future. But should they be taking any lessons from political figures in the Liberal and National parties who had 9 years to resolve these issues and failed to do very much about it?
Now, oppositions, of course, have to provide an alternate vision for what they think should be done. That's them doing their job. The trouble is that 3 weeks of a new government after 9 years of neglect isn't the time to start formulating this vision. I don't quite know what the best thing for them to do is, except to shut up and look at ways that they can improve their credibility, really. And regular listeners of the podcast will know that I'm about to say, and I hate saying this, and I do hate saying this. I'm looking forward to where we have an equally capable opposition as government and both being capable. Obviously, compromised interests like Matt Canavan with his family in mining really should be very careful. Angus Taylor with his own business dealings. Because the public has looked at it and has said, enough, we don't like this. There'll be some rusted on Liberals, of course, and there'll be some people who don't really look closely at things and make the correlation between a new Labor government and then crises in power supply. All I can say to those people is correlation is not causation, and that, as you said earlier, it's been a problem that's been 9 years of really... neglect's not quite the word. It was more disruption, making sure that the natural market solution, which was to go to renewables, was ignored to actively pour more money into older forms of energy production. And with that happening, we now found ourselves in a spot where the market has failed so badly they've suspended trading in it. Hopefully this will mean free electricity for everybody, but I haven't adjusted the budget quite yet.
But the delivery of electricity and energy, that's actually up to the states and the territories across Australia. The federal government doesn't actually generate any energy at all, but it can be responsible for the overall directions. The coalition did propose a national energy guarantee in 2017, and that was under Malcolm Turnbull and Josh Frydenberg, but that was dumped when Scott Morrison became Prime Minister in 2018. The Labor Party at the time, they did announce that it was going to adopt the national energy guarantee as its own energy policy. And there haven't actually been any announcements on that since the change of government 4 weeks ago. But Turnbull's policy proposal has been the only serious attempt to address national energy issues over the past decade. And we're not suggesting that it's an easy process. There's a wide range of different energy types. There's different jurisdictions that are responsible for their own power sources. There's internal party politics. There's also the influence of political donors. And we have to remember that the Labor Party also receives a substantial amount of donations from resource and energy companies. It's not just the Liberal and National parties that receive donations. So there's a lot of competing interests. But in all of this, the consumer seems to be the one who was left behind. Over the past decade, it's just been an aimless meandering from the federal government. So I think it will be interesting to see how the Labor government tries to address these energy issues. It's not an easy fix. And I guess they'll soon find out how difficult it's going to be.
For all of those reasons that you suggested, plus a couple more, practicality and logistics, it's a transition. We can't say, right, by the end of the financial year, there'll be no more coal and gas, it'll all be renewables. It's a thing that can take probably a decade or even two, which is why the last 9 years were a complete waste. They could have started it in 2013 or even 2015 or even waited till the election in 2016. That still gave us 5 or 6 years further down the track. With a looming climate crisis, with some experts saying we've only got 10 years, some saying we've run out of time, and others saying, no, there's 20 years. Any good planning would plan for the worst case scenario while hoping for the best case scenarios. And this is the problem. It's not that we can do it quickly, and no government can. Labor can't. Jacinda Ardern's government in New Zealand couldn't, although they're a long way down the track. It just takes a while. It is logistics, it's politics, it's the lot. So the sooner we get started on it, the better. And the other thing we've got to do is cut out the delays, because the process will take long enough as it is.
Well, one issue that I've noticed is that everyone has got the advice about what the new Labor government should do on energy and energy prices. The media is now having a good look at this, even though they haven't really taken too much interest over the past 9 years. The opposition is also suggesting all the ways the government should fix this energy crisis or the energy problems that we're currently having, even though they couldn't actually do much about it when they were in government. They're recommending that nuclear energy should also be on the table. There's been many reports into nuclear energy in Australia over the past 60 years, and all of them have shown that it's not a viable energy source in Australia. So the time for nuclear energy, if it was ever going to happen in Australia, would have been in the 1960s. In the 2020s, it's probably just not on, and it never will be. But the last nuclear energy report was commissioned by Angus Taylor when he was Energy Minister in 2019, and he announced this as a smokescreen for all the allegations of corruption that were circling around him at the time. But that report announced the same results, that the nuclear power industry in Australia is unviable, so it's unclear why the opposition wants to discuss it now, unless they're mainly interested in causing political mischief. Peter Dutton did announce during the week that the energy crisis is the problem of Chris Bowen's making and he needs to fix it. Chris Bowen, of course, he's the energy minister. He's only been in office for 4 weeks. But the problems of this magnitude don't arise within 4 weeks, and it's certainly not going to be fixed within a four-week period. But we can see that after 9 years of not being able to resolve the issues while they were in government, the Liberal and National parties are keen to make sure that nobody else can resolve these problems either.
Their legacy, which is a very small and limited one, is completely under threat. The whole nuclear thing, I think, has to do with the fact that there's money in it, because you still have to buy and sell the commodities. You can't really buy and sell wind, or you can't really buy and sell the sun. I'm sure there's somebody in an office somewhere trying to work out how these things can be commodified. You need to sell the means that utilizes this stuff, the equipment and things. But once it's in, that's it. Whereas with nuclear power, you still need to mine uranium, you still need to mine the cobalt, you still need the water to cool them down. They use a tremendous amount of water, which is partly why in Australia it's not a good idea. Waste storage, I imagine that could be a very lucrative, if ineffective, thing for someone to do. It's a technology that, unless you're 110% sure that it's safe, it's not safe. 1 in 10,000 or even 1 in a million chance is too big a risk. If there's someone out there who can point me to genuine research that shows that it is 100% foolproof. And I know that the reactors today are a lot better than the reactors that Japan had, that Three Mile Island had, and that Chernobyl had. But it still isn't safe enough, I don't think. And so, one, I think the Liberal Party is trying mischief to try and get people off renewables, and then you get them thinking about nuclear energy. And then, of course, oh, yeah, nuclear energy isn't safe, so we've got to go back to gas and coal. So that's probably a tactic too. And I don't think it's going to work this time. I think that the environment is way too big an issue, which is something, again, that the Liberal Party should pick up. And we'll talk about this a bit later.
The Australian Energy Market Operator, they've intervened and they've actually put a cap on prices that energy suppliers can charge. And this has been introduced to guarantee supply. But energy and electricity supply is an essential service in Australia, as it is in every other country around the world. South Australia and Victoria are the only fully privatised electricity services in Australia. The New South Wales grid is partially privatised. But there have been some calls to re-nationalise the electricity grid all across Australia. And whatever the case is, I think it certainly needs to be made more efficient. But a country such as Australia should have an efficient and reliable electricity supply. And that's something that was promised under the National Electricity Market. And that's the network of suppliers of all areas, except for Western Australia and Northern Territory. And there have been some benefits in having this system in place ever since it was created in 1998. But the system promised lower prices and reliability. And it seems that we don't have either of those at the moment. And it might be a time for a rethink about how this entire system works and whether it is the process of re-nationalising the national grid.
One of the things I think happened in the last few elections in Australia, and we're seeing it happen overseas, there's a seismic shift started, and we're seeing the death of the neoliberal experiment that failed almost as soon as it started. Those of us old enough to remember the privatisation of the GIO in New South Wales, where they were promising green slips for $99 because the competition would force the price down. We now see that we have this compulsory insurance that is $300 and $500 a year on cars that are worth $300 and $500. Privatisation has failed. It served nobody except those who it was always meant to serve, the owners of the system. And the owners of the system, of course, were bought in through means that might be seen as corrupt. Government assets sold at a bargain basement price, given to companies who weren't really up to running them as a public service. And as a result, we have skyrocketing prices, falling services, and a failed system. Now, is there a third option? There might be, giving it into what used to be called quangos or not-for-profit area, for example, might be a solution, but I suspect we're just better to renationalize at least infrastructure and give people a cap on electricity of X amount a month and water, and anything over that they spend, they can pay for. And that alleviates the burden of paying bills on low-income earners, etc. And if you want more, you can buy more. I don't see a problem in that. And I really think most people won't see a problem with that, provided the cap is fair and reasonable.
So energy is one issue that the media is taking a strong interest in, but there's also a few other areas or a few other issues that the media is taking a strong interest in after not taking any interest for a long, long time. The issue of asylum seekers and boat arrivals are starting up again. There's been three boat intercepts over the past few weeks from Sri Lanka, and that includes the one that arrived on election day. Very, very convenient. For 9 years, there was absolutely no reporting at all on on-water matters, and apparently there weren't any boats at all coming into Australia for 9 years, and we know that that's not actually correct. And it is that old philosophical question: if a boat crosses the Indian Ocean with asylum seekers and there's no one there to report it, does the boat still arrive? So apparently it's all okay to report on and speculate about boat arrivals now, but I was surprised to hear one story on the ABC during the week about Sri Lankan people, smugglers, telling their clients, hey everyone, there's a new Labor government in town and they're welcoming boat arrivals. Now, it is fantastic that the media is holding the government to account, even for things that they're not responsible for, but where have they been over the past 9 years when all the action was taking place?
Well, they spent 9 years criticising the opposition, and now it's the government's turn. I think that's only fair enough. But of course, to be serious, they prefer the Liberal National Party. We've looked at the owners and who owns this stuff in the past. I think in some parts of the media, not all, and I've been fair before, and I want to reiterate too that it's not every single journalist. There are excellent journalists working for all news outlets. So I don't want to say that if you work for Company X, you must be a terrible journalist. Statistically, you might be, but there are notable and honourable exceptions. But the owners of media didn't want Labor to win. It was clear that they didn't want Labor to win. And interestingly, this time, the Sydney Morning Herald gave a half-hearted, oh, we think Labor's going to win the day before the election. And most of the rest of the mainstream media, I'm not talking independents, hello to all our independent friends out there, were pretty much solidly hoping that the government could pull off another miracle victory. This didn't happen, of course. And so I think they're trying to help get the other side back in. I think there is an element of, well, we've got to get them back in because it suits our interests. They are sort of saying, too, things like, oh, it's balance, which they haven't worried about the last 9 years. Why you'd have Barnaby Joyce on morning radio and Matt Canavan on afternoon radio when there are many, many other people, both inside and outside of government, who could give better analysis than either of those two. And I know Barnaby's supposed to be good radio, but looking at the ratings, I don't think he is. And that's the ABC too. It's harder to criticise private because private can do what they want. It becomes a bit of a joke. Some senior Australian journalists, again, not all, some are very worried, seem to think that what they think is important and that that's the main aim of the news. It's what they think, not what is going on.
You're listening to New Politics. You can subscribe to us on Apple or Google Podcasts, listen through YouTube, SoundCloud and Amazon Music, or find us at newpolitics.com.au, and you can now support New Politics through Patreon.
The Labor government has finalised the compensation of the cancelled French submarines deal, and the overall project was worth $90 billion, and that's been concluded at $830 million. And just to be clear, Labor didn't cause the cancellation. That's something that the previous Liberal National Party did. And it was estimated that the full cost of compensation was going to be $5.5 billion, and that includes the payment for the work that was already completed. Labor's negotiation has brought that cost down to $3.4 billion, and that to me sounds like a pretty good reduction. But the media and the opposition is complaining about this, with the Shadow Defence Minister, Andrew Hastie, claiming that Albanese needs to explain to the Australian taxpayers how $830 million is a fair and equitable agreement. Well, for a start, it's not really a fair and equitable deal for Australia, but Albanese isn't the one who cancelled the contract. He saved $2 billion in the process. It's not clear what Andrew Hastie is actually complaining about. But we can see that already this is setting up a specific type of narrative, blaming the new government for everything, and over time, well, people won't remember who was responsible or caused which problem in the first place. All they'll hear is Labor is responsible and needs to fix it, and they will then wear the blame. And it's an audacious and brazen process that they're adopting at the moment. I guess all political parties do this when they're in opposition, but I think we'll just have to wait to see whether this is an effective political strategy or not.
There's a real case with Andrew Hastie in be careful what you wish for,
because if Anthony Albanese does decide to explain what happened,
I suspect that the last government won't come out very well, because there were the most extraordinary things. Morrison leaking texts. Barnaby Joyce saying, don't worry, it's only a contract, as if a contract has nothing to do with the very basis of, not only in the Judeo-Christian Westminster-style law that we have here, but in international law. It's all based on contracts. Through to the French president accusing Morrison again of being a liar. I don't think, I know, which was one of those phrases that resonated.
There's also been requests for the new government to act on Julian Assange. He's been in Belmarsh jail since 2019. He's been denied bail. He's been refused permission to appeal his extradition to the United States. And we have to remember that the international warrant for his arrest was issued in 2010, and the Gillard government did nothing to support Julian Assange at that time. Julia Gillard said at that time, well, there's nothing that we can do or anything that we should do about this. And of course, the LNP hasn't done anything to support Julian Assange during the past 9 years that they were in office. But Albanese has said that enough is enough, and he couldn't see what can be achieved by his continuing incarceration. He did say this while he was in opposition early in 2021. Now he's the Prime Minister, so it's time for him to act. There's also several other whistleblowers currently in Australia who are facing prosecution, and that's Jeff Morris, Richard Boyle, David McBride and Bernard Collery. And there are calls for Labor to drop these cases and provide more protection for whistleblowers. Now, on all of these issues, Labor definitely wasn't the cause of them, but they can act to resolve these long-standing issues. They can't blame the previous government. They can't go and hide and try and do something different compared to what they were calling for in opposition. The issues for these whistleblowers need to be resolved quickly, and especially for Julian Assange, who's been languishing in a British jail for over 3 years.
The Australian, or DFAT, the Australian Foreign Affairs, were always good in looking after expats who'd got into trouble, even when they were guilty, lobbying for lighter sentences, lobbying for them to be sent home to serve an appropriate jail time in an Australian prison, making sure that they weren't being tortured, making sure that they were getting their basic rights of food, shelter and medical when needed. Is Julian Assange guilty of anything? It's hard to tell, because the information that was leaked to him, by the way, may have compromised interests leading to the deaths of people who maybe wouldn't have been killed otherwise. But it's certainly the truth that Assange did nothing except shine a light on authority. And that, again, is the basic basis of democracy. Transparency, understanding what is right and wrong. Now, of course, when you get into the murky world of intelligence, laws and rules get murkier. But Assange wasn't part of that world. He had received information that he thought was important to be public. Collery and Witness K and all of those guys were in intelligence and felt that there was a moral issue that needed to be exposed in the workings of the Australian government. And I think they were right in that. Some things are kept secret for arguable reasons, maybe not valid reasons, but for arguable reasons. Other things shouldn't be secret at all. And when a government tries to hide things from its people, we're in a lot of trouble.
Well, I guess the other issue is that, well, someone like Julian Assange, he's been in jail for 3 years, and it's not like he's in a jail where there's no extradition arrangements between Australia and that particular country. He's actually in a British jail, and we should be able to do a lot more than what's currently being done for him at the moment. But again, it gets back to that issue that Labor did make all of these comments and statements while they're in opposition, and now they're in government. Now is the time that they should be able to act on all of this, and it's no point in saying as much as you can while you're in opposition when you can't do anything about it. When you're in government, that's the time to do it. And I do accept that there's going to be a whole lot of diplomatic issues that have to be taken into account. And as Anthony Albanese did say, well, there's no point in using the megaphone to bleat out all of these issues and criticise the British government or the American government about this. You do it behind closed doors. And of course, we won't know what's going on behind these closed doors until information is released. But as I said before, it's probably time for the Australian government to do something about not just Julian Assange, but all of the other whistleblowers that are currently facing prosecution in Australia.
I think laws protecting whistleblowers from coming forward, at least, And their argument is, oh, you just get nutcases with grievances and things. And sure you do, but you can have procedures that whittle those people out and have some kind of consequence for people making up stuff or for misrepresenting stuff. But people who have seen genuine wrongdoing in a company or in a government should be allowed to. It's funny, the police always appeal for witnesses in an unsolved crime, which is essentially whistleblowing. This should be well across all segments of society, well across all segments of the law and of government. If you see something, say something, whether that is dodgy drug dealing at the end of your street or whether it is dodgy government dealings with corruption or improper happenings. That should be the law from one end of the spectrum right to the other, because that's the only way a democracy can function. And I should also add, he's still got enough political capital in that we can accept that they're working backstage to try and alleviate things for Assange and even free him. And if this is happening, when it plays out, we can examine it then, whether it was the right thing or not.
You're listening to New Politics. You can subscribe to us on Apple or Google Podcasts, listen through YouTube, SoundCloud and Amazon Music, or find us at newpolitics.com.au, and you can now support New Politics through Patreon. Under the withered and white skies of humiliation, under the withered and white skies of
It's been 4 weeks since the federal election, and now is the time that all the party officials start to look at what went right and what went wrong. It is a tradition for the National Secretary of the winning party to provide an outline at the National Press Club of why they think they won the election, and this week it was the National Secretary of the Labor Party, Paul Erickson, who provided his speech. And he gave his reasoned opinions about why Labor won and the 8 main reasons why he thought the coalition lost. And these are the main areas the Liberal and National Party should be focusing on if they ever want to return to government.
If there is a common threat to these three issues, it is that the Liberal Party of 2022 is defined by nastiness and incompetence. The 8 factors that led to their defeat were: 1. A pathological refusal to take responsibility for anything, which comes from their small government mindset. 2. Incompetent management of the federal government's responsibilities during the pandemic. 3. Cabinet-wide partisan attacks on state and territory governments throughout COVID, which particularly alienated voters in Victoria and Western Australia. 4. Incompetent budget management. 5. An incompetent and incoherent response to the cost of living crisis. 6. Incompetent engagement with our allies and our region. 7. A lack of awareness or interest in women's experiences across the economy and society. And 8. A decades-long failure to take climate change seriously. Scott Morrison may have come to personify these failures, but they are institutional and collective, not individual. They are actively prosecuted by senior cabinet ministers and all coalition leaders, including the 2 men then seen as the only likely successors to Scott Morrison, Josh Frydenberg and Peter Dutton.
Winning election strategists are always presented as the genius political campaigner, and the losers are presented as weak and useless, and that's the way that it's always been, but it's not as clear-cut as that. Winning an election is always very, very difficult. It's not as though your opponents don't put up a fight in an election campaign, but there are lessons for all sides of politics from this past election, and I think Paul Erickson has provided the Liberal and National parties with some very valuable free advice.
Some of it was very obvious, and I don't mean that to sneer at him. I mean, it needed to be said. Stuff like they didn't pay enough attention to the environment. That was clear.
nearly all the crossbenchers, all of whom won Liberal seats, I think, apart from the ones who were already in seats, like, well, Rebecca Sharkey in Mayo, which was a Liberal seat, and Andrew Wilkie, his seat, which had been a Liberal seat, and Adam Bandt, who took his seat off the Labor Party. The other two Greens took their seats off the Labor Party. So a lot were taken from the Liberal Party. And all of those independents, except for Tu Lee in Cabramatta, who's slightly different, said they would have voted for the Liberal Party had things been different. And that's something that I think the Liberal Party has to take on, because the Liberal Party is in a complete existential crisis and is probably dying. We are watching the death of the traditional party system. And I'm looking at the few minor parties that get through. It's really only the Greens who increase, and I'll be fair, the Nationals who maintain. Everybody else loses primary votes, and most notably the Liberal Party. Now, I know that they're pointing at the Labor Party and saying, oh, you only got so many primary votes. As we explained last week, that's the preferential system. The preferences flows, and that's what I'm still kind of working through, are very interesting. And I think that the vote to Labor was staunched somewhat by preferences. Looking at numbers, looking at how voting preferences flowed in the Senate, looking at how minor parties did, I can see that we are somehow seeing the death of the party system. First thing a lot of you sharper people are going to say, and you're all very sharp because you listen to this podcast, is, but what's it going to be replaced with, David? And I'll say, well, that's a really good question, and I'm still thinking about it. And there's a sense in which I don't know, and I'm not sure that anyone knows. And I'm also not saying that by the next election we won't have a Liberal Party or a Labor Party. We'll still have Greens. We'll still have Nationals. The support there is still strong enough for them to go on. But it'll be interesting to see next election if the primary votes, if the voting patterns have changed further. But I think we've started a shift in how things are done.
Well, all the political parties, whether they win or lose, they assess their respective election campaigns. And of course, if they lose, especially if they've lost several elections in a row, like the Labor Party did in 2013, 2016 and 2019, they tend to do a deeper analysis of what went wrong. But I don't think there's a causal relationship between doing a deep review and then you automatically go on and win the next election. I think there's quite a few different issues involved here.
Definitely.
But in the same way the 2019 election was seen as the unlosable election for the Labor Party, I think the 2022 election was the unlosable election for the Liberal and National parties. They lost an election that they didn't need to lose and they shouldn't have lost it. And if only they had been a little bit more competent, they might have been able to win, but they weren't competent at all. And all of those issues that we've been discussing over the past 3 years, the lack of vaccines, the poor management of the bushfires and other natural disasters, hotel quarantine failures, not getting the rapid antigen tests organised in time, Scott Morrison and Josh Frydenberg abusing different electorates at different times in Western Australia, Queensland and Victoria. This was all a recipe for disaster, and we called it out for 3 years. Many other people in the independent media sphere were also calling it out for 3 years and beyond. And the Liberal and National parties will have more time to assess and analyse their performance over the past 9 years in government. And I'm sure that they'll look back at the previous term and they'll say, what on earth were we thinking about? Why did we think that this was all going to win us an election and all we had to do was turn up and we'd win quite easily? And I think that in the same way as Labor threw away their time in government in 2013 for a whole range of different reasons, I think the Coalition threw away their time in government at the 2022 election as well.
They definitely did. And it sort of pointed too to the South Australian election being a little bit of an anomaly, because we said at the time that the Marshall government, for its faults, it had handled the pandemic well. And it was the first government that I had seen that had handled the pandemic well that had lost. The idea that the mismanagement of the pandemic was a factor in the Coalition's loss at 2022 federal election is key. And around the world, we saw governments who had not handled it well get defeated and governments who had handled it well get returned till South Australia. And I thought then, oh, that's probably the end of the pattern. But in fact, it looks like that was an anomaly. There were other issues in South Australia, of course. I don't wish to state that the Marshall government was a perfect government that deserved to win and were cruelly thrown out of office by a vindictive and poor electorate. But there was the corruption, there was the poor infrastructure management, there was all of that. But all governments get that. So it is interesting. They've identified as one of the factors, and I agree with them, poor pandemic management. The vaccine rollout was terrible. It's not a race. You didn't have to be a medical expert to see that it is a race, because this thing spreads. And the quicker you can get people vaccinated, the quicker you can lock them down, the quicker you can get them wearing masks and stop moving around the cities, the better it would be. We're still in crisis mode. They've just now gone on the let's stick our head in the sand and forget about it. You know, let's pretend that we're not losing 70 people a day and that we're not getting tens of thousands of new infections a week. It was deserved for them to lose, and there may be more consequences.
And the election might all be over, and the shouting is all over as well. It's been 4 weeks since the last election, but the opinion polls continue. And the first one after the election, or the first major opinion poll after the election, comes from Essential Poll. It's not comprehensive, but it does look at the approval ratings of Anthony Albanese, and it shows a 40-point turnaround in his approval ratings. 59% approve of his performance right now, 18% disapprove. So he's got a net approval rating of 41 points. Just before the election, his net approval rating was 1 point. So that's a massive turnaround. It's very early in this new term of parliament, and that's generally what happens after an election result. The electorate tends to validate what they've just voted for. Scott Morrison had similar approval ratings just after the 2019 election. But the slog of government, the opposition parties getting their act together, events that change the dynamics of politics, issues that have to be resolved, whether people like it or not. But like all oppositions, the problem for the Labor Party was getting back into government. But once they actually get back in there and they start looking like a government, the electorate is generally supportive until they have a reason to not be supportive of that government. It's also a factor that Anthony Albanese needs to be aware of, and he also needs to be very careful in this stage of his prime ministership. But as Paul Erickson said at the National Press Club, you're never as good as your last election victory, and you're never as bad as your last election loss. Scott Morrison had very high approval ratings in the early part of the pandemic in 2020, and the media at that time, they actually suggested that he was the next Bob Hawke and the greatest prime minister ever. Well, he squandered all of that, as I've described before, and he ended up just becoming the next Scott Morrison. He didn't become the next Bob Hawke at all, and he ended up losing the 2022 federal election. And instead of becoming the greatest prime minister, people have started asking the question, well, was Scott Morrison the worst prime minister in Australia's history? And I can only base this on my own living memory and my own personal experience, but definitely the worst that I've come across. But David, your understanding of Australian history is better than mine, and there's been a lot of bad prime ministers to choose from, but was Scott Morrison Australia's worst prime minister, in your opinion?
Short answer, yes. And this is in a period of time which gave us Tony Abbott, who could only hold on for 2 years before his own party turfed him out, despite being a leader in conservative politics. I've said before, there were people who loved Tony Abbott and still do, who still think that he was the great missed opportunity and that the leftists in the party ran him down. There are people who liked Scott Morrison, but I don't know that you got that same level of love that Tony got from a small group of people, by the way. I don't want to build the myth that he was universally loved by everybody, and that. But we've got to be fair and we've got to look at everyone's thing. Morrison loses a lot of support. In his drive to put smaller government, where we had a need for government intervention in the bushfires. Again, on Twitter, I saw someone said we shouldn't call him the member for Cook, we should call him Captain Cook, because he came and plundered, covered it all up for him and his mates, and then went and died in Hawaii. He never recovered from that. The other thing is that he never learned from it. He'd say he'd learned from it. There was this sort of whinge that, oh, we haven't had an overseas holiday in 2 years. Diddums. None of us have had an overseas holiday in 2 years, and there's a whole bunch of people who, even if the country was open, wouldn't have had an overseas holiday because we couldn't afford it. He says, I don't hose a hole, that's not my job, that's not my job. And in fact, that could be written on his tombstone, that's not my job. And that's why I think we can call him the worst prime minister. We struggle to find any achievement in the government. Maybe a couple of tax cuts, a couple of refugees beaten on and oppressed, It was government by media release. It was government by superficial image. It was government by corruption. I think that it won't get too much attention in the future. When the broad histories of Australia are written, it won't be mentioned that much. But it's worth remembering, if only so we don't do it again.
That's it for this episode of New Politics. Thanks for listening in. If you'd like to support our style of journalism and commentary, please make a donation at our website at newpolitics.com.au. We don't beg, plead, beseech or gaslight you about journalism coming to an end. We just keep it very simple. If you like what we do, please send some support our way. It keeps our commitment to independent journalism ticking along. I'm Eddie Djokovic. Thanks for listening in, and it's goodbye to our listeners.
I'm David Lewis. We'll see you next time.